welcome into the Fan pregame here on Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590 Fan for the next hour. We've waited quite a while to have game three of the NBA Finals tonight. A 1-1 tie, of course, between OKC and Indy. And they're going to be on our network at 8:30 p.m. on Sportsnet. We can't wait for that. Your team.
Yeah, I'm like the Oilers fans, I think, right now. Like an extra day of nervous energy for, I guess, reasons that aren't as drastic for as they are for the Edmonton Oilers, certainly. But, yeah, I'm interested to see what the OKC Thunder look like tonight, because it looked like they kind of took control of the series, or at least established some sort of alpha dominance in game two. But maybe the scene shift will change things a little bit for the Pacers and maybe continue to make this series interesting.
Yes, we just come in the room here after Blair and Barker talk about another Blue Jays win, and you can tell the Blue Jays are winning because the vibes are good with Blair and Barker. Like, they're chipper, making jokes. And
you're not supposed to divulge those Jeff Blair secrets.
Oh, you know, he's always very chipper around these parts, to me at least. I'm lucky. But I think he's been enjoying the Blue Jays action as of late because they're red hot. Another win today, just earlier before we came on the air.
Yeah, and this road trip, obviously, three cities, nine games. They got a day off before going to Philly. Get to see the Phillies again.
Not but, bad, eh?
You know, you're 5-1 on this current road trip. It kind of sets up a scenario where if you do the bare minimum, it's a fantastic road trip just in Philly alone. You've got three free roles at the table, I think, and you got Gausman and Berríos who are going to be ready to go this weekend in addition to Bad and Francis, who may or may not surprise us. That is the ultimate free roll, I suppose, at this point. But yeah, they're in a great position to make this three-series road trip like one of the fine moments of the season. Hopefully it doesn't peak that way. But yeah, this is when you're looking back on potentially, hey, where it went really well or really right on this season, when you're maybe getting ready for a playoff series, might look back at this nine-game road trip.
I hope so. Yeah, what was it, 13-2 in their last 15 games?
Like, rolling.
They are rolling. We'll talk a little hockey around 6:30. Jason Buchla will join us. We'll go through what needs to change for the Oilers in tomorrow night's action as they are down 2-1 to Florida Panthers. But our next guest kind of gets to be in the best of both worlds right now. Tim Reynolds, who joins us from the Associated Press, one of our great friends. Tim, we appreciate you coming on. What a life you're living right around these days with Florida and the NBA Finals. It's a good time to be you.
Yes, except my beloved Phillies are terrible, and I expect the Jays to sweep this week. It's just, we're so bad right now. We're so awful. Toronto's going to go 8-1 on this trip, and good for them. Congratulations. Thank you. Put us out of our misery. The season's gone. It's
really. I mean, we need.
I'm a Philly. Being a Phillies fan, quitting in the second week of June is kind of what we do.
Okay. Yeah.
So this is just me being me, but the Jays are going to get at least two out of those.
Yeah, I was a little interested when they had such a great start because I'm looking at the team that looked like it had its window closed, and it's kind of exactly the same, or at least the lineup is very similar. Not to say it was a bad lineup, but it just felt like nothing had really evolved when you see the Dodgers evolve in this crazy way. But again, they're not worried about the Dodgers at current moment. You're in Indiana. Finals are back in Indiana. What's that like?
They're a little nuts here. There's a little Pacer mania going on. There's a little Caitlin mania going on. The secret is going to get out here in a couple of days that she's going to play against the undefeated Liberty here on Saturday, and we get two finals games before then. So for small markets, for the 25th market and the 47th market in the U.S. rankings, and the ratings down here are terrible and nobody cares, these are two wonderful basketball cities. Obviously, Indiana basketball is as much in the DNA as anything in the state. There is hope. I mean, they went to OKC and they got one. They stole one. Now they have been outplayed in seven of these eight quarters. I mean, there's no getting around it. The Thunder are very, it's unlucky that it's not a 2-0 series right now for the Thunder, but the Pacers figure coming home, they're going to play better. More shots are going to go down. I know this isn't exactly a sizzling hot take because it's game three of a 1-1 series, but I think both teams know that tonight is going to go a long, long way to deciding who Adam hands the trophy to.
Yeah, it's a big one. I would argue it's bigger for Indiana in that I think if you get that adjustment again from OKC, it's 2-2, you go back and it's 2-3 and you got two games at home. But in that case, Indiana would be making it far more difficult, I think, on OKC than many would expect. There's a lot of hesitance, though, in your voice. So what is your actual confidence level that when you're looking back on this series, you will remember one that was entertaining, compelling, enthralling, however you want to put it.
Not high, Justin. It's not high, unfortunately. I mean, it's good ball, but there hasn't been drama. These are young teams. There's no back and forth. Nobody's spraying a water bottle at the other bench. Nobody's pinning Matthew Tkachuk's arms down. Like, none of the fun stuff. I'm missing the fun stuff. The fun stuff's happening in Sunrise. I'm here with two relatively well-behaved teams. What's the fun in that? I think it's, again, this is what the Thunder have been all year. They are, I don't want to say Tim Duncan-esque in fundamental, but they just do everything right. They are excellent at what they do, and what they do is not particularly exciting. And for basketball people, that's great. That's fabulous. Like, this is beautiful to watch. It's just that quote-unquote casual fan, it does not appeal. And unfortunately, we're in one of those series where it just does not appeal to the casual fan. So, no, I don't think this is a finals that we're going to sit back on in 2035 and say, remember 10 years ago how great it was? No, we're not going to do that.
Yeah, but you do have a Canadian star. So here's my Connor McDavid to Shea Gilgeous-Alexander parlay.
And our Canadian athlete of the year
there
race,
is.
That is hotter
so
than anything
So that's
going right
to be
now.
Hot, and I'm sure yes. You'll be on the beat for that. But combined 72 points in his first two ever NBA Finals games. Like, this, that's a new record. Shea doesn't seem to shy away from the moment. This is his opportunity. Like, what do you think this start has meant to him for solidifying, like, his superstar status in the NBA? And north of the border, it's there.
It shouldn't have done anything for it. He's the MVP. If we are not calling him a superstar by now, then shame on us. And yeah. and Shea doesn't care about any of it. I mean, the free throw merchant thing, I've cringed at that. And I've actually thought about writing the opposite. Like, it's so
write it, Timmy. Come on. Easy retweet for me.
No, because I don't want to justify it. I don't want to justify a flawed theory by writing about it. He's had the perfect season. He's the perfect leader for this team. He is so incredible. He's quickly becoming one of my favorite players to watch. Tyrese Halliburton also in that conversation, who's another great guy. They're super smart, super quiet guys. Like, they just show up and they do their job and they go home. Why don't we appreciate this more? Why don't we appreciate Shea more? It's not because, well, he's Canadian, we don't care. Like, he played at Kentucky. Like, we've seen as much of Shea Gilgeous-Alexander. We've seen as much of him in this country as we have literally anybody else, because we pretend we watch high school basketball. No, we don't. We don't know where these guys played high school ball, especially now where guys change every year where they're playing high school. He played a year at Kentucky. He's been in the league. We know his story. My favorite part of the last month was, now granted, it was in the Panthers-Toronto series when I saw Shea jerseys.
Don't remind us.
That's the great, but no, it's great. It's great. I mean, you knew you weren't winning that series.
Yeah, we knew.
You knew you weren't winning that series. And the Marner jerseys on clearance right now story, oh my gosh, what a, I absolutely have fallen, I'm so in love with Toronto, Simon. I absolutely am. And you'll probably get Benny or somebody, you'll be fine. It's shame on us for not making Shea a bigger deal. Now, Shea does not want to be a bigger deal. Like, he is going to become a reluctant superstar, much in the same way that Tim Duncan wants, much in the same way that a lot of guys were. He's not going to be punch my chest, I'm out here looking for the attention. He wants no part of it. That MVP speech should go as viral as KD telling his mom, you know, you the real MVP. The way he looked, you know, at his family, the people who have been around him, the people who have been in his corner the longest and broke down unprompted. Like, why didn't we appreciate that moment more than we did? I don't understand why people are choosing to miss out on it. Shame on them. He's incredible. He is the Canadian Athlete of the Year. There's no argument on that. And let me tell you something. I had a conversation today with somebody about Olympic planning, not just for 26, but for 28. It just made me think ahead a little bit to what the LA Olympics are going to be like. Yeah, Canada's going to be a problem, folks, for the United States and Los Angeles in 28. And it's going to be because of SGA. So it's time to it's time to get on the train because he's going to be good and he's going to be really, really good for a long time.
Yeah, he's our guy and he's the guy for the Thunder, and the Thunder are going to be really, really good for a long time. So eventually, despite maybe some resistance, he is going to break down some of those walls that you're speaking about. You mentioned Haliburton being, you know, a superstar in his own right, and he is, but this is a tough, like, juxtaposition here for him, I think, because you watch Shea and it hasn't been free throw merchant stuff through games one and two of this series, not even close, but he's the type of guy who can get his own shot, make shots, fill up the basket, unlike Haliburton, who is succumbing right now, it looks like, to elite defense, the elite defense of the Thunder and who they can throw at him. Clearly he had his moment in game one, but are we seeing the limitations of Haliburton so far in this series, in that he's not like Shea, who can go one-on-one and score? He kind of needs his offense to come slightly easier, I'll put it that way.
But I don't want to disagree with you that much. Well, I'm not going to make excuses. Like, there's clearly some sort of Achilles tendonitis ankle issue with Tyrese, but everybody's banged up at this time of year. Not making an excuse for it. I think he can go one-on-one. That's the thing I do sort of disagree with you on. I think that's how you have to do something to make the Thunder defense react to you. If you play offense the way the Thunder dare you to play offense, which is move the ball, work the shot clock, try to find the opening in this airtight Thunder defense for 24 seconds, you are playing right into Mark Daniel's hands. You need to attack. You need to make the Thunder react to you. If you let them dictate the terms of your offense, you cannot beat that team. You have to go at them. And that's why I think tonight Tyrese Haliburton has to come out hyper-aggressive. He is not a pass-first guy, not always, but he defers a lot because it's the Pacer way. It's how they got here. They got here on this all-for-one, one-for-all kind of thing. They haven't had a 20-point scorer yet in these finals. Somebody needs to step up tonight, whether it's Pascal, whether it's Tyrese, Miles Turner, somebody. Somebody has to clap their hands and say, give me the ball now, and make the Thunder react to them. Otherwise, you're going to play into OKC's hands.
I'm glad you mentioned Pascal Siakam, because obviously with his Raptors roots, we want to get a touch point on him. You know, he had the series before. He was one of these stars, whether it was agreed upon or not. I don't know where you were. If you get to vote on that or how that works, but it was interesting.
I wasn't there. I didn't. Okay. I didn't vote.
Who would
on
you
it.
Have voted for? Have...
Hope you're knocking Pascal. Some heads together. Really?
Pascal.
Why?
Pascal. Yeah.
Because he loves Toronto.
I love Toronto, but...
Haliburton had one of the great games ever and had the shot in game one and was really good in the other one.
Moments are not games. Moments are not games. Pascal dictated so many things in that series.
Okay.
And I love Toronto.
And you love Toronto. Okay, so looking at the opportunity at hand to at least keep the series close, like how much more of this falls on Pascal to have a good game tonight, game four, hopefully elevating himself if Tyrese can't be all just Tyrese?
Well, I think Pascal is the best opportunity. I mean, I know the Thunder defend from the rim out. And, you know, Isaiah Hartenstein, elite rim defender, not a big name. Not a lot of people are like, they're rolling their eyes when I say Isaiah Hartenstein's a key, but he kind of is.
Not me.
If Lu Dort is going to have his attention on the perimeter, if they're going to devote 1.5 people to stopping Tyrese Haliburton, then you're playing 4 against 3.5 with Pascal Siakam as one of the four. Pascal gets into open areas better than, well, as well as any player at his position in the NBA. He knows his sweet spots. He can get to his sweet spots against this team. If this is one of those nights where Pascal Siakam shoots the ball 24 times, the Pacers are probably going to win the game, because I don't think the Thunder have a consistent answer for him. They have consistent answers for just about everybody else. The great equalizer, of course, is if Indiana comes out and makes 22 threes, if Obi Toppin makes 5 threes again, if Tyrese goes 6 for 10 from three, if TJ McConnell, who's not really a three-point guy, but if he comes off the bench and gets you 14 points in 16 minutes, then it all goes the Pacers' way. Those are all ifs. I think the one absolute is you feed Pascal Siakam early and often, he's going to set a tone. And the team that adjusts first, like I've been saying, the team that has to get away from what it wants to do first is going to be at a pronounced disadvantage. Indiana has to find a way to make OKC react to them. And guys, I'm pretty smart, but Rick Carlisle's a lot smarter than I am. He knows all this. I think you're going to see a healthy dose of Pascal early and often tonight to try to set some sort of tone.
Okay, last one on game three of the NBA Finals tonight on Sportsnet. Before we go, we got to get a little Panther talk, a little cat talk with you, Tim. Is anyone building it like the Thunder? And I ask that, and I'll frame it this way. Like, if you are not an elite defender, you don't play for Mark Dagnall. At least it seems. Like, all these guys are unbelievable defensively, and it is such a foreign concept, it seems, where that is, I guess, requirement one. Is anyone looking, or I'm sure people are looking at the Thunder thinking, hey, we got to do it similar to this. But is this, like, so unique in that it's defense first in an NBA where it just seems like it hasn't been like that for many, many years?
There's a team in Texas with a center who is currently studying to be a Shaolin monk, apparently. The Spurs are kind of doing it this way, where there is still a defense first. You have to defend to be part of it there. There are elements of it with other teams, of course. I mean, the Warriors don't get enough credit for being, I mean, everyone just talks about Draymond. They don't talk about the team defense. It's not the same. But with Draymond and Jimmy Butler, it's a very defense-oriented group now out there. There are other ones sort of like OKC, but to me, it's the Spurs that stand out as the team that they went 22-60, they went 24-58, they went 35-47, 34-48, whatever it was this year. They're building that end first because they know you can't win without it. Victor Wembanyama is going to get his. They're going to get – the Spurs are going to be a team that does something either on draft night or at the start of free agency. They're going to get a big name. They're going to be a playoff team next year. That means somebody's coming out of the playoff mix in the West. They're going to be better. They're going to add the scoring because they think they have the defensive base now. Look, Miles Turner just passed Victor Wembanyama in the last couple of weeks for most block shots in the league this season. It's June. Vic hasn't played since February. The Spurs have a pretty good defensive plan down there, led, of course, by Vic.
All right, we're talking to Tim Reynolds of the Associated Press. Okay, let's shift to hockey because I know you want to talk about your Florida Panthers. What an interesting dynamic these Rats are kind of like running the show in a sense with Marchand and Bennett, the two guys that really are Florida Panther hockey. You did make a little passing comment about 5 minutes ago that, oh, you'll probably get Benny. So Sam Bennett, Toronto, you know, what do you think about all these options that the Florida Panthers have after this series?
That was one of those ones where I couldn't stop my mouth in time.
Yeah, well, we'd be happy with that.
Thinking about it.
You can plant the seed.
I don't think it's out of the question. Mm-hmm. I mean, Toronto's obviously going to get somebody, and everybody's going to want Sam Bennett, including Florida. I don't know if Florida has the wherewithal to keep him. I really don't. So someone's going to get him. It is so funny, though, that Sam Bennett and Brad Marchand, you would never think would be BFFs. Mm. And here they are as perhaps the two biggest keys, or at least statistically, they're the guys people would talk to. I don't think we're doing anywhere near enough talking about the way Bob has been throughout this postseason. I think Bob is probably, if the season ended tonight and they had us all vote hurriedly for the Conn Smythe, it has to be Bob, I think. And Sam Bennett's had an unbelievable postseason. Brad Marchand's had an unbelievable postseason with moments. The way that this team has gelled, bringing in Marchand was a really big deal. And then he couldn't be around the team really for 3 weeks. They were on the road. He's back in Sunrise rehabbing. He didn't really join the group per se until like mid-March. It's like he's been there for 5 years. And I wish there was a way to explain how they fast-track it. There isn't. They literally, like that stuff in the Carolina series was true. There was a DQ next to the hotel. They literally would go get the Blizzards thing were real. The Blizzards in the locker room were not real. The Blizzards thing where they just go, they go out and eat ice cream together. Which hockey team does that outside of like some Mites team somewhere? This is the Stanley Cup champions doing it. And Marchand is legitimately like lobbying for a DQ deal.
Yeah, how is
any of this real life?
We're going to bully grown men for 60 minutes and then go out for ice cream. That's the Florida Panthers right now with Brad Marchand. It could not be more true.
Make it make sense, but that's exactly it.
You know, I mentioned, you know, Thunder being kind of singular in the NBA right now, and maybe the Spurs are going to get to that point, but it feels like maybe the Panthers are even more singular in their ecosystem, which is the one team that is so comfortable in the nastiness, in the mud, as we call it a lot. Like, are they completely unique in the same way that the Thunder are completely unique in the NBA and NHL?
I think so, and I think, I mean, obviously I live there and I cover them, and what Bill Zito and Paul Maurice have done, what they laid out and what they did, and the courage slash silliness to take a President's Trophy team and tear it down to a 92-point team that people forget had to, that got into the playoffs 3 years ago by the skin of the skin of the skin of their teeth. Like, this was not, it has not all been roses. And then they make this first cup run and then everybody gets hurt and Vegas absolutely smokes them in five. And the way they have bought in to just, we're going to play this way. We're going to play for a 7-game series. We're going to spend the first 6 games of a series chopping you down. And then we're going to go to game 7, wherever it is, and we're going to win. A lot of teams wouldn't buy into how hard it is to be a Panther. And that's the thing Brad has talked about since he got here. They work hard. They do everything right. Matthew Tkachuk has said it too. Like, off the ice, like, they're as about as silly as possible. Shooting the rats at Brad and all that stuff. Completely organic, completely silly. But practice time, like, there's none of that. Like, you know, we're allowed to go in and see practice, and it's Paul Maurice barking at guys and guys doing their job, and Bob is being Bob and all those things. When they're working, they take it super, super seriously. And I think that's the thing that they think separates them from everybody else. They have the belief that they're going to work hard enough to get it done. Paul has put them through 3 excruciating training camps. He's already talking about the things he can do with them in September at the next training camp, about just how much more he can make them hurt
that,
now.
That might drive Sam Bennett to Toronto, if anything.
It might drive Sam Bennett to Toronto, but we're hoping not. I think announcing that on national television he has bubonic plague, I think that probably will help keep him in Florida. He's the absolute best, that guy. For whatever reason, no team is willing to step up and do it their way. Mm-hmm. I mean, and they do. It's not always pretty. You know, Matthew Tkachuk isn't filling the stat sheet right now. Alexander Barkov is not filling the stat sheet right now. But the guy, I mean, A.J. Greer. Nobody wanted A.J. Greer. A.J. Greer comes in and it makes an immediate impact. Gadjevich is like the biggest thing in South Florida right now. And no one knew who he was a month ago down there. It's just because these guys are willing to block shots and do whatever it takes. Why 31 other teams are not mimicking it, I don't know. Perhaps it's because of income tax, although I think it goes a little bit deeper than that.
Oh, that's a big can of worms.
Smart people know that.
Yeah. If you mention the word tax, it gets really contentious around these parts. So you know your audience well.
Listen, Tim, we wish we had your tax reality. We'll just put it that way.
We'll take that.
I'm not in a TV tax bracket, so I wish I had your tax reality.
Good retort
that's
there.
Good. That's right. Well, Tim, we got to let you go, but this was a blast. Great to get a little hoops talk and hockey talk with you. And I assume you think the Panthers are going to wrap this up quickly. So I don't know if we'll talk before the Stanley Cup is handed out, but probably during free agency when we take some Panthers to Toronto. How about that?
I'll wish you well when that happens. Okay. Cats in six. I'll talk to you from the parade.
All right. There you go. Thanks so much. Tim Reynolds of the Associated Press. I definitely need Tim Reynolds on FaceTime on a float at the parade.
He could very well be there. Was there a parade last time? I know there was.
Yeah, there's got to be a parade.
There was like Atlantic Ocean.
And they
Ocean
went in
stuff,
the ocean. And they went to Elbow Room.
If there's any criticism towards everything that's happening in Florida, is that the celebrations did not look incredibly attended.
They're just used to it now, I guess. Yeah. No, that was a great chat. I definitely want to get more into like building the Panther way, because our next guest will know that. Jason Buchla will join us in about 5 minutes. But let's get to our U.S. Open Golf Report. This golf report is brought to you by your local Ontario Subaru dealers. Subaru, welcome to Uncommon. We talked about it yesterday. U.S. Open tees off tomorrow morning at Oakmont. And we've got 4 Canadians in the mix for you this weekend: Taylor Pendrith, Nick Taylor, Corey Connors, Mackenzie Hughes. A lot of people, myself included, big on Corey Connors because of his ability to hit the ball long and accurate. And so he finished 9th at the U.S. Open last year. He sits 8th on tour at driving accuracy. We just talked about how important it is to get away from the rough at Oakmont. He's 13th in greens and regulation on the tour. That is going to be your bread and butter. So if you're looking to find a player that's going to score well, getting it on the fairway and on the green and being able to putt well. So I'm looking forward to seeing how Corey Connors does. And then Taylor Pendrith was talking to our Adam Stanley, who has a great article up on sportsnet.ca, And he's feeling really good about himself. He had a great PGA championship. His video and his chat with Adam Stanley is available to watch. But basically saying that he got to play with, at the major championship with, like, the top players in the world. He feels really good about his game coming into it. He's been playing pretty well. So
yeah, don't discount Taylor Pendrith with the combination needed at Oakmont, which is driving distance and driving accuracy. He's the longest Canadian golfer on tour. The accuracy sometimes can fail him, but it's reasonably good. So if he's having a good driving week, Taylor Pendrith might be neck and neck with Corey Connors in terms of Canadian flyers at the U.S. Open.
We'll do a little bit in our best bet segment, too, before we say goodnight, because the bet's going to be in by tonight or tomorrow morning because they tee off tomorrow at Oakmont. Okay, this golf report was brought to you by your local Ontario Subaru dealers. Subaru, welcome to Uncommon. We will take a short break, and Jason Buchla will join us. He is back from Buffalo. He's ready to tell us who he thinks is going to rip the pill best in the first round of the NHL draft.
I hope so. No T-shirts made in time for the combine?
I have time to get it ready for him for LA, though. Well, rip the pill.
There you go.
Okay, Jason Buchla on the other side of the break.
Hey, it's Matt Marchese.
And I'm Mike Fiuta.
We're discussing the top stories of the day across the NHL and the hockey world, weekdays at noon.
It's the Fan Hockey Show on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Fan pregame here on Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We just chatted with Tim Reynolds, who got a set for Game 3 of the NBA Finals starting tonight on Sportsnet at 8:30 p.m., an off night for the NHL, but not an off day for the Oilers, playing some tricks on the media, saying, oh, no, we're not doing anything, and then having a full practice.
Yeah, I mean, what I don't do you know think really. About that? What, I guess our next guests probably have a better idea of what that actually means, but maybe guess they didn't want to talk to the media today. Why wouldn't you want to talk to the media? Are you trying to divorce yourself from the media? I don't know. Maybe they're overthinking it a little bit. It wouldn't be the first time, that a team has overthought it against the Florida Panthers.
All right, let's bring in our friend Jason Buchla, Sportsnet NHL analyst, former NHL director of scouting. Books, what's up, buddy?
What's up, guys? How are you?
That's a loud shirt.
It's a loud room, too. Like, do you have to, are those like slightly tinted glasses? There. It's bright.
Buddy, I just try my best. I got a face for radio, and then you splash me up there on the TV screen. What am I going to do, right? I mean, it was, as you know, David Siss and I have been trying to connect, and I had some other photo ops today that included this beautiful shirt. So here we are.
All right. It's a bold look, and you're a bold Thank guy. You. So I don't know if you heard us bringing you in, but what's with the Oilers having an off day and then actually practicing? Like, any shenanigans there?
Gamesmanship. Oh my goodness. Not in the NHL playoffs, the Stanley Cup playoffs. It's they're just playing around. And I will say this, though, they're coming off a game where clearly the opponent was deep inside their head and it went off the rails. And this just speaks to another type of example of them trying to hibernate a little bit, I guess, trying to get away from some of the noise in their own little way. And that's fine. It's I don't read anything into it. I'm good with it. We've had tons of media avails, and I don't know what else could be said today other than, I guess, injury updates, which you're not going to get, and you're going to get misled by line combinations and the like. So it's fine. They got to present the best version of themselves tomorrow night, obviously, coming off that shellacking the other night.
It certainly was a shellacking, probably the most mortal game we've seen from Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl combined in these playoffs so far. So if you're going to have success against them, it can't be all self-inflicted, I imagine. So what did the Florida Panthers do so well denying McDavid and Draisaitl in Game 3?
Depth, structure. You know, there's so much one and done with Edmonton the other night. They didn't give them any opportunity to come at the Panthers net in layers, if you will. And even off the rush, they would guide the play to an area of the ice. And they did this in the offensive zone too on Reinhardt's goal. They take the play to certain areas where they take away options of even the best players in the world. They're really proficient at it. Off the rush, there was no secondary layer because of the back pressure. So when McDavid would enter the zone with speed through the neutral zone, cutting off the flank, there's nobody really there. If the puck gets knocked off his twig or if there's not another play to be had, there's just nobody there. There's no support. So real good structure. They know how to play the game a certain way. They don't shy away from that. Actually, they dare you to play the game any way you want. It's just going to end up being their way at the end of the 60 minutes, it seems. And on the Barkov play where he took Klingberg to the corner, I think Kevin broke it down really well, or maybe it was Friege on the broadcast. Where
it's probably Kevin.
We'll go with that. And I don't like giving Beaker any more, compliments than he ever deserves. I mean, he's already the star attraction, for crying out loud.
It's probably so, Elliot.
Barkov took him to the corner, and he took him into an area, obviously into the referee, but where was the ref going to go? He took him in an area where the puck was going to get exposed, and it was in the back of the net. So what I'm trying to tell you is that it's just hard. They take you into areas that are uncomfortable, and they limit your support coming in extra layers.
And then the discipline, like, obviously it got out of hand for the Oilers. They want to dial that back in. And I remember Connor McDavid's quote from last year, like, dig the bleep in. I don't know if they're at that level yet, but being able to play their game and not succumb to the way the Florida Panthers want to say, which you said was, we'll play any way you want. But there's a specific way that the Panthers like to play. And so how essential is it for, in these 2 days off, this extended time for the Edmonton Oilers, just reset, come back, don't bring any of that angst that we saw near the end of the game, and just play their brand of hockey?
Yeah, it's more important to the Oil than it is to Florida. I don't get the impression that Florida is as beat up in some key categories as Edmonton is. You know, the Nuge is obviously playing through some injuries, and they've on the back end, they seem to be a little bit more worn out, the Oilers do. So a couple of days off is going to be good for them. I just feel like Florida probably would have liked to get right back after it the next day. But having said that, with the maturity of that group, their third Stanley Cup final in a row, a couple of days off isn't going to hurt them either. Now, the one thing I would say, guys, is that you've been there in South Florida, and Los Olas Boulevard and the beach and the Elbow Room. And I'm not saying the Oilers are going there, but let's just say that it's hard to, and your downtime, not be distracted by all the fun things to do down there as well. So it's not like they're sequestered, but at the same time, they know what the job entails here, and they're going to have to present, like I said, a better version of themselves. I don't like the fact that they really got off their game between the ears. You could just tell they were just rattled, and they tried to do things that is a throwback to the 80s and maybe the early 90s to try and get Florida to goat them into certain things, even at the end of the game with Perry on Mäkelä, like when he was cross-checking them and hammering them in the back of the legs and stuff like that. But Florida just isn't biting. They're kind of saying, been there, done that. You guys, we got you where we want you, right in the corner. So, yeah, this is a heavy lift for Edmonton. Got to reset.
Yeah, situational know-how is certainly still favoring the Florida Panthers, who know exactly what every situation is going to look and feel like and how to react to it. So it'll be hard for any team to beat them at that game. On the Panthers side, obviously Sam Bennett is a huge, huge story here, but he's kind of like an incredible conundrum in so many ways because, you know, he's got the contract this summer. But I just think at like the prospect level, the scouting level, you know, this is a guy who is clearly better when it matters the most. And then you have to evaluate that and juxtapose that to, hey, what's he going to provide in the regular season when you have to just make the playoffs across 82 games? Being patient with someone who you think is going to be big in big moments. Like, how hard is that as a scouting staff, as a managerial staff, when you know there's something there, but that something kind of stays in the bottle for long stretches of a hockey season?
Yeah, well, you know, it's for him to play the style of game that he plays between games 1 and 82 is a seriously heavy lift. It when you can bottle it up and expose it in playoffs, obviously, you know, I'll take you back to his draft cycle. This is an easier way to put it. When he came through the Kingston Frontenacs, he wore number 93 for Kingston, and Doug Gilmore was coaching the team back then or around the team still. And I remember in our war room when we were talking about him at the top of that draft class, one of the things that we pointed outside of the number is that he plays like Doug Gilmore did back in the day. He's got that mentality, that makeup, that drive. Now, Gilmore was different, of course. He scored a lot more. It was a different era. He scored a lot more, but he had that style. You know what he was. He had that rat, that backup rat game as well, right? the answer that we came up with for ourselves to make ourselves feel comfortable is that if we had the infrastructure, this is a guy that makes us better at the hardest times. And I'm not just talking playoffs. I'm talking about the night that we got to get in. You know, like it's a do or die game. It's game 82. Let's just say that. Or it's a statement game in February against cross-state rivals in Tampa Bay. These types of scenarios. And you don't have to wind these types of players up for those moments. And that takes something off of the coach's plate in preparing teams for big, big moments. And you're satisfied with that, Justin. You understand that the numbers in regular season, let's say he's got 20 tucks and 30 assists in regular season, and he's making 9 sheets. Well, on the surface, people are going to say he's overpaid. But then when he goes into playoffs and he's got 12 and he's driving to the net and doing what he does, you're going to say to yourself, well, that's worth every dime. And so is the owner, by the way, because the deeper you go into playoffs, you're paying off those bills. So everybody's happy. I think he's going to stay in Florida. That's my gut feeling. Everybody's going to be after him, but I just feel like it's too much of a good thing to leave down there. That's my guess. I think he's going to be somewhere around Verhaeghe money, so in that mid-sevens down there, which is different in other markets. Boy, oh boy, how good does he look? Is he not in the MVP talk for playoffs?
He is the minus money favorite right now to win the Conn Smythe.
Are you serious? I wonder, do you guys recall when he started at? Do you remember, was he even on the radar at the beginning?
Did you guys plan this?
I swear I didn't ask him to ask us this. Justin and I.
Hold on. Don't go.
You guess.
I was at dinner last week at the Combine with Ailish Forfar. Mm-hmm. And she announced to the room, not just us at our table, if you want to call it a table, not just us at the Last Supper that we were having. She announced to the room that she had money on this opportunity. And if things go our way, she's taking us out for Wagyu steak in LA.
I don't know about Wagyu.
That's why I thought it was planned.
Okay, so
To answer our question,
we before the Stanley Cup playoffs began, we were going through the bottom of the list on the betting odds, and he was 460-1.
We actually got it, I think, like a week into the playoffs.
Yeah, like it was crazy.
He had a couple goals.
So, yeah, we could get like a baby Wagyu for all.
My money's not going to be spoken for. I guess you're going to have to buy steaks for the crew. So
I would gladly do that.
You better not cash out.
No.
Are you in on that too, Justin?
No, Justin.
No.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you're in on Sam Bennett.
Oh, yeah.
He's in on Sam Bennett.
I'm not in on Sam
Bennett, but you have different
responsibilities. I'm way in on Sam Bennett.
Yeah, you have a young family to feed and stuff like that.
They can eat Wagyu,
like little pouches that are
those like goo things. Okay, I want to ask you about how GMs – so Florida's been on a very successful run, as we know. They could win another cup. They've been to 3 in a row. How are GMs and scouts and organizations going to try to replicate what Florida has? Have you seen it anywhere else? Is there a way to – do a little copycat league and say, well, we can be the Florida Panthers light and start to change our mentality?
Oh, real hard to do. Real hard to do. I would suggest to you guys that the first thing that you have to do is you have to build around. Everybody talks about the core. Like every team has a core, right? And we've talked about in Toronto for 9 years and the core. Well, I would suggest to you that the core in Florida, that's what you have to be comfortable with to start with that and build around. And you're going to take some risk around your core when you know you've got something special. So, you know, when you got a Barkov in your lineup and you know how he's going to play every night and you know that he's going to be eating up 25, 26 minutes against the best players, and you got the Ekblads of the world, then you got the Bobrovskis who you can count on. So what I'm trying to say is that it's hard to do unless you're really super comfortable with how your core is built. So in Edmonton, for example, you know, the core has been top heavy, but they've done a nice job of trying to build around that as well. I don't know if it's going to get them exactly where they want to go. I'm hoping it does because, as I said before, I'm a homer. I want this to come home to Canada, and they're not out of this yet. But it's really, really difficult to do. And what you also have to do while you're building it is you have to have the culture that can introduce veteran players at key times, i.e. the Brad Marchands, like 2 years ago or whatever it was, 3 years ago, when they brought Claude Giroux in, they didn't go on the run. And I'm not saying that it had anything to do with Giroux. The timing just wasn't right. Fast forward to this cycle of bringing in a Brad Marchand, it fits, and it fits the right way, and there's a culture there, and he adds to the culture. So you can chase that, Ailish, but it's really hard to replicate.
We're talking to Jason Bukla, Sportsnet NHL analyst, former NHL director of scouting with the Florida Panthers. You were in charge, or you were part of, drafting Alexander Barkov. And one of the things that struck me, and Aaron Ekblad, one of the things that struck me from game one, when they're doing the introductions, and it's like, hey, in year 9, it's this player. In year 10, it's this player. In year 11, it's this player. And you kind of went down the line, and they're all pretty much double digits in terms of tenure. And maybe that's a seniority thing and starting lineup, whatever. But I was thinking, like, maybe it just takes 9 or 10 years for a player to get to the point where they're going to lead a championship charge. So when you're – what's that? Run it back Leafs, yeah, exactly.
Oh, I said run it back Leafs. My mic was off, sorry.
And we digress. Well, they can't because they paid everyone too much. And Mitch Marner, you're selling jerseys. Anyway, Barkov, you draft him. Are you thinking, like, hey, we're going to win a Stanley Cup in 4 years because of this guy? Are you thinking, hey, in 11 years, this guy is going to be the guy who can anchor a championship team?
We're not thinking 4 years. We weren't even close to good enough yet. We had a lot of building to do. We built, and it wasn't just about building what you guys see on the NHL roster today. What you have to do is you have to build up a closet full of assets. Like, you have to have organizational strength, because organizational strength then brings in opportunities to add to your NHL team. So if you go down, yeah, at the top of it, you got the Barkovs, you got the Ekblads, you know, we bring Bobrovsky in free agency, but look at the guys that that got farmed out. Look at the guys that were left behind, so that Bill Zito, who's done a phenomenal job, and his staff, they built the team the way that they wanted to build it. But Matheson goes out, Montemil goes out, Owen Tippett goes out, Spencer Knight goes out. So what I'm trying to tell you is that if you build up enough assets and you manage them accordingly, then it gives you the flexibility. But we weren't anywhere close when we drafted Barkov to say we had enough assets or projectable assets to be Stanley Cup contenders in that window. We really did think it was going to take a lot longer, and it did. But to everybody's credit, Scott Luce, who's now with Vegas, Aaron Janelle, who's with Vegas, all of the staff that I was with that are, most of them are no longer there, Evan Marbles in Washington doing a fabulous job. Like, it's no surprise, pardon me as I foam at the mouth here for a sec, because I think people have to understand, it's no surprise they're as good as they are in Vegas and as good as they are in Washington when some of those same people were building the Florida Panthers back in the day. Mm-hmm. And it's infrastructure, and you build out those assets, and then it goes from there. And somebody else implemented the plan here, and they did a heck of a great job. But that's how you do it, Justin. It takes, you need draft capital, you need patience, you need to do it the right way.
It was year 15 for Sergei Bobrovsky, by the way, in those introductions. I guess the rational thought would be, well, he can't do it for years 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, right? I don't really know. But you were part of the crew that brought him in. Longevity had to be something that you considered. How is it that this guy in year 15 can look like he's, you know, spring chicken still?
Yeah, it's incredible. Well, first of all, I find that athletes are much more finely tuned today, even goaltenders. If they're lucky to get through a certain stage in their career where their hips aren't going, and with the way that they play the game nowadays, because he is a butterfly athletic goaltender. But yeah, I got to say this about Sergei Bobrovsky. As soon as he came in, and Lou was going out the door. Roberto Luongo was gone. Spencer Knight was coming in. We were in transition there. We bring in Bob. Bob's work ethic and the way that he prepares is second to none. Like, he doesn't take practices off. He's very structured. He has a certain way that he wants his body to be feeling, and he's wiry to a fault. Like, he's in fantastic shape, and he's obviously got the mental makeup to be great. And some goalies, some players are great, but they don't have the mental makeup to be great at the hardest times. And he is a future Hall of Famer. There's no doubt. And I look back at everything that went on with us back then. When we signed Aaron Ekblad to an 8-year extension for 7.25, I think it was at the time, people were like, oh my God, you're overpaying for that. How good does that look now? You know, across the way, you got Darnell Nurse, he's fine. He's a good player, but he's making much more money than Aaron Ekblad. You know, Alexander Barkov was making 10. When we signed Bob for 10, it was the worst contract in the league, until it wasn't. He's gone through 3 Stanley Cups now. So, yeah, it's a process. But Bobrovsky, I think he's going to play north of 40. I mean, honestly, think about it. Ed Belfour, what did he play till 41? Something like that in Toronto? And, you know, Eddie the Eagle wasn't exactly taking care of himself.
Yeah. He was like a different regimen there between those two.
He was having fun. He was having fun for sure. He was spending his per diem a different way. Let's just say that.
Yeah, I'm sure he was.
He was drinking the wine. Sergei Bobrovsky handing the wine out.
Handing it out. That's right.
All right, we're talking to Jason Buchla, who's also going to be on in the draft coverage. We only have a couple minutes. Like, we could open-ended. We were down in Buffalo for the last couple days of last week. What's the most impressive young man that came across our room for you?
Ooh.
Wow. Well, I thought, to be honest, and I'm not dodging the question, I thought to a man that this group was really good. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any divas in there. They all seemed to identify with a trajectory that's realistic. So I didn't have anybody in there saying that, you know, that I know is a third line guy saying, oh, I'm going to be a first line 90 point guy. None of that. But Matthew Schaefer, it's an easy one. He's at the top of the table. But listen, how many young people in the world today can go through the death of a mother tragically to cancer, the death of his landlady, like his billet mom in Erie, who he's very close with, all sorts of tragedies, and then setbacks physically with injury, and still present the way he does on the ice, but more importantly, walk around that building in Buffalo and just light up every room that he went in. This kid is a quality individual that I believe no matter what he was doing, if he was flipping burgers at McDonald's, he'd make the best burger. If he was on a PGA Tour this week, he'd win the U.S. Open. Mm-hmm. There's some special people that came through last week, but Matthew Schaefer is a special, special young man to me.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It was really great to kind of share some of those stories. Like, they were very vulnerable. I agree. I had never gone to the draft combine, but my understanding from listening to you and Sammy Cause was that it was a really good group of kids, humble, driven, some like not cocky, but confident. And I like that we have an all character team that we created of guys that you'd want on your squad. So it was a lot of fun.
Well, Justin, I know you want me to go, but the best part of it is that we had the good cop, bad cop, and then we had Ailish, who's like the icing on the Oreo cookie. Like, Sammy's a good cop. I come in with some hard hitters, and then Ailish just makes them feel super comfortable at the end.
That's very nice.
You did a fantastic job, and I'm really looking forward to working with you in L.A. It'll be fun.
Thanks so much, Boogs. We'll let you go. Enjoy tomorrow night's game, and we will definitely chat soon. And I can't wait to see what you pull up if you're wearing that and, you know, where London, I bet you got some sweet LA fits.
I'll be ready to go. Bring me on for an hour next time.
We will.
I was going to say, I need like the full college like drama breakdown of what's going on here. Gavin McKenna, you know, future of junior hockey. That wasn't like a 90-second answer. So
we'll book you in.
Let's do that, you know, in a couple weeks.
We'll book you in.
There's a lot to unpack. I'll let you guys go. I appreciate you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Books. We'll see you soon. That's Jason Buchla, sports NHL analyst, former NHL director of scouting, pro hockey group as well.
And so he's the bad cop?
Oh, yeah. It was really...
Sammy's the good cop?
It was really sweet to see the dynamic.
And you're like taking off the handcuffs so the prisoners can leave?
Yeah, it was kind of like that. Yeah. Sammy would go in and he'd just be like, so, you know, what's like the hardest thing you've dealt with? And the kid would be like, wow. And then Books would be like,
oh,
why'd you fire Regent? You going back to college? What's going on? Are you going to go to NCAA? And then I'd be like, let's circle back on, you know, the tragedy of your family. It was just like a lot. But it was really sweet. And they
Sammy Cosentino could just disarm you with his words.
He's like a soft, soft soul. And so is Books, but Books plays into more of like the good cop, bad cop.
Got to play a role with you two.
I think it worked well. The kids were caught off guard by every angle of questioning. So we had a blast. Okay, quickly, we'll do our best bets before we wrap up. I talked about it, U.S. Open. I think I'm going to just lean with Corey Connors' top 10. I've seen it around like plus 340. That's where the best price is. And I just going to go with the Canadians. Canadian golf is hot right now, and Connors has the skill set to shoot well. I don't know if he has the skill set to win. So how about he has a great weekend and finishes top 10?
Okay. I'll accept that.
Yeah.
I can't really accept the state of betting golf right now because Scottie Scheffler just wins every important event. It's actually more fun betting like the Rocket Mortgage Classic because Scottie's not there. But you can get around that. You can bet without Scottie Scheffler. And two guys I like this week to probably place second as their ceiling to Scottie Scheffler are Ludvig Åberg and Sepp Straka, both guys who can hit
Straka
it far
guy.
And sometimes very straight. So Åberg, 16-1. Without Scheffler, Straka 30-1 without Scheffler. If it's Scotty's world, maybe one of these two can be in his orbit for a bit.
And we mentioned it, but Conn Smythe favorite now minus 120 in some books, Sam Bennett, which might be time to buy in Brad Marchand plus 800.
You took the words out of my mouth. If you're trying to protect a big ticket, 460.
That's what you do.
I saw someone tweet Sammy McKee with a 480, so we don't even have.
Oh.
We can't even brag anymore. But if you're protecting that,
I thought we
Marshawn
were on it first.
Seems like the guy to me.
Okay, so Brad Marchand plus 800 in some books.
Despite what Tim
There's
Reynolds.
A lot of emotional, like, storytelling. He's the guy right now. Maybe the voters are like, what a story.
You can be seduced by a story. Wouldn't be the first time.
You definitely can't be. And then Connor McCabe still plus 270. So Bobrovsky plus 12 or 12 to 1 is also not bad. Okay,
Tim Reynolds rushing to his book.
We do. Okay, we got to go. We will see you tomorrow. Have a great night, everyone. Enjoy game 3.